previously on Ridiculous History. I'm kidding. I just always love when those voices come in at the beginning of something, like on Lost.
I was going to just chime in and be like, what happened? I want to know. I was there and I don't even remember.
Right?
I'm Noel, by the way.
You're Noel. I'm Ben. We are joined with our guest super producer, Paul Deccant, who has an awesome sound cue.
Love that.
I love it too.
That thing, whatever that is. Does Paul get to pick out his own sound effect? Because he's actually filling in for super producer Casey Pegram here in spirit.
Nice.
That's where the sound effect goes, Paul. And so, yeah, Paul could potentially pick out his own sound effect.
That's true. And I thought you did on a previous episode, Paul, but we can't wait to hear it.
Wait a minute. We've
we've been informed.
Paul's had a sound effect all along, and we knew what it sounded like. It's sort of a mission control, you know, bleeps and bloops kind of sound effect.
Yeah, it's very spacey.
I'm just bummed that Paul doesn't get to pick out his own sound effects. Clearly, Casey picked that out for him.
Yeah, Paul, if you want to pick your own sound effect, you completely have agency. Thanks for hanging out
with us. I think you should, you know? I think we should chuck. Casey's not around. Screw him, you know? Just chuck it out.
How dare you?
Whoa. I have feelings. Casey abandoned us for France.
Yeah, well, Casey is living his other life and will return across the pond.
It's his best life.
Also, he is going to be back, so we need to be careful what we say about him. I don't want to angry Casey.
He's not going to hear these. He doesn't even edit them. He's not going to go back.
You don't think he listens to the show
for fun? He might go back and just to see if we talk any trash.
Hey, Casey, thanks for tuning in.
Love you, buddy.
And if he hasn't listened, fellow Ridiculous Historians, do not snitch on us. We're being very serious. But in our continuing streak of telling spookier tales as we get closer and closer to Halloween, Noel, you and I have touched on some gruesome practices such as cannibalism, and we've touched on legends of monsters, but today we're looking at real-life monsters.
Yeah, I mean, says you.
Okay, all right. Yes, we're talking about serial killers, and it is true that in the U.S., often serial killers are given this kind of infamy. They're almost like there's something that's occasionally celebrated about them, which
is
terrible.
Yeah, especially in, like, you know, in our industry, the podcast world, where it's like we're just up to our ears in true crime stories. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually working on a true crime story right now that is a little different. It's not so much celebrating the idea of the serial killer. It's a little bit more of looking at what it means to be human, what it means to have these impulses, or to what the obsession with serial killers actually means to us as a culture. Like, why is it so fascinating? My theory is that it makes us feel better about ourselves. It makes us be like, well, I'm not that crazy. Mm-hmm. At least I've never actually murdered multiple people.
And one of the—
I just yell at my mom.
Yeah, right? I'm not that bad. One of the factors in this almost deification at times is certainly the question that people end up asking themselves, would I be someone capable of this? Could I understand that mentality? And it's a deep and dark question, but luckily we're not going too far into the psychology of that kind of process on today's show. Although we do want to hear what you think about it, feel free to write in. We're ridiculous at howstuffworks.com. Today, instead, we're delving into a question that has personally, and just speak for myself here, personally haunted me for a while, and that is this: who was the world's first serial killer?
Yeah, I actually Googled this, Ben, like you do when you're trying to find things out. That's what we've been reduced to, is professional Googlers. You know, I don't even know how to use a card catalog.
I go to the library. You know, I live next door to a library.
You go there?
Yeah, I go there.
You go in there?
Yeah, I love libraries.
I like libraries too. I'm kidding. I know how to use the card catalog. Point being, I Googled first serial killer, like I'm doing right now, and a name that commonly pops up is a guy named Herman Webster Mudgett, known as H.H. Holmes, and he is considered, on paper at least, to be the first American serial killer.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But the story we have today is not about Mr. Mudgett. It's about a lady serial killer.
Yes.
And the notion of the serial killer name is divisive, and I think there's an issue with maybe calling this person. This person was more of an assassin, really.
Yes, more of a poisoner. I do want to stop, though, because you mentioned H.H. Holmes. There's an amazing book, if you haven't read it yet, The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson.
White City being Chicago.
Yeah. H.H. Holmes built a murder house. Gruesome, grim, and gory stuff. But you're right, Noel. There's a question about what makes someone a serial killer. And we've looked into this in previous episodes on other shows. This person, Locusta of Gaul, was a poisoner. She wasn't out there, you know, sneaking up behind people and cutting their throats.
But one could argue, because of the benefits that she enjoyed with the protections that we're going to get into of that she experienced, that she may well have fallen into a pattern where she just kind of did it for lulz.
Yeah, definitely not a mentally healthy person. So this occurs in the first century AD. We don't know a ton of stuff. We don't know very much at all about Locusta's early life, other than that she was from Gaul, because that's what people called her, Locusta from Gaul. Maybe there were a ton of other Locustas, and there was like Locusta from Rome, Locusta from Gaul. Maybe that's how they differentiate. But Gaul itself was where northern Italy and the Alps are, and it's got three geographical regions around the time this happened. What I'm saying is it's a big place.
Well, it's France now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's France and then northern Italy. So we bring this point up to say that knowing just that she is from Gaul doesn't really help us, right? Like,
what we do sort of know about her, though, is that she grew up living off the land, as it were, or at least in terms of like some of the species of plants that were available in that region. She was an active forager, mm-hmm. and kind of got herself real familiar with some of the uses of some of these herbs and flowers and various things that could be used for good or for ill.
There we go. I like that dramatic note. Yes. So,
or for ill.
Or for ill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah. We got it. So, this person living off the land has a encyclopedic knowledge of the different plants that grow in her area and the different medicinal or nefarious uses of these plants. People recognize talent, and there was an empress named Agrippina the Younger who noticed that Locusta had, as Liam Neeson would say, a certain set of skills, and Locusta, at this point, was already pretty notorious.
Yeah, how did her reputation precede her that it made it up to such high levels of government and, like, influencers or whatever, Ben?
Well, they stopped calling her Locusta from Gaul and started calling her Locusta the Poisoner. So that became her new name.
Wasn't she also Locusta the Sorcerer at some point?
Yeah.
She's a woman of many names. Crazy. So she was already kind of, like, doing little hits.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, and even getting arrested, I believe.
She was imprisoned when Agrippina approached her in AD 54. And Agrippina had a particular job for her. She said, Locusta, I want you to poison my husband, Claudius.
Ooh, real quick. There's an amazing name given to her profession mm-hmm. that combines her, like, you know, knowledge and know-how with herbs and their uses with this idea of being an assassin.
Lay it on me.
Necro-entrepreneur.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and this was coined, maybe not coined, but used in this particular situation by Dr. Catherine Ramsland, who is a PhD in psychology.
Yeah, first off, that's my favorite phrase that we've learned recently, and people did, in a way, respect this person's abilities. There were multiple poisoners in the area in ancient Rome at the time, but Locusta was by far one of the most well-known and notorious.
We're also going to get into why, because it wasn't just that she, you know, anyone can slip somebody some poison or just like make poison or find it or
arsenic,
whatever.
You just
go buy it, right? But she was very wily and clever and crafty. And as we'll get into the next story involving her employ under Agrippina, that becomes infinitely clear.
There's an excellent paper I found called Poisons, Poisoning, and the Drug Trade in Ancient Rome by L. Silliers and F. P. Retief at the University of the Free State. And in this, they give us some more details about exactly how Lucusta came to be in the employ of Agrippina. So she had been convicted of multiple crimes during the reign of Claudius. She was a known repeat offender. She was bad medicine, which I guess works on a couple of levels. But let's keep going. Agrippina, you see, was the second wife of Claudius, and she had a son named Nero, who I am sure is familiar to a lot of ridiculous historians
here. Yeah, yeah, it was the name of that app you used to use to burn CDs back in the early 2000s.
Oh, wow, deep cut,
remember,
man.
Nero?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's because, but the reason it was named that is because Nero was a bit of a pyromaniac, and he was known for burning Rome to the ground to some degree.
Playing a fiddle. Maybe. Allegedly, yeah, that doesn't really.
There's another story that we're going to get to that allegedly happened. But it's fun to talk about, you know, legend and myth can sometimes be more interesting than the truth.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed. So as we were saying, Agrippina wants her son Nero to be the new ruler. And she asked,
like a lot.
Yeah. Like, yes, a life or death sort of desire. And she asked Lucusta to poison, Claudius.
Yeah. Right? That sounds good.
And she did it with, it was almost like a heist because, as you can imagine, this guy has a lot of security.
Yeah, tasters even.
Mm-hmm. He's got a food taster named Halitus. So what does she do? How does she get past this?
Do you think that's where halitosis comes from?
We can only hope.
I would love that. I want that to be the case.
I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, so she, like, I don't know. How did she exactly circumvent Halitus? It was a little weird. Like, did she bribe him to kind of get out of the way? Is that what happened?
So the way she gets past this is through the use of poison mushrooms, which originally are given to the emperor by his food taster. But that doesn't quite work, right?
I don't think so. Yeah, so I read that she, Agrippina, bribed this food taster to kind of get him out of the picture and then gave the mushrooms to her husband herself because apparently he was like a huge mushroom fan. He really, really liked the shrooms. I can relate to that.
And some people will say that, or some sources at least will report that the closest aide, the food taster, was sick. And then others will say, no, Agrippina bribed him to malinger.
Either way, he wasn't around.
Right.
And the mushrooms went directly into the hands of Claudius, who was apparently a little drunk. And he did not kill him, but it made him convulse violently and have really bad tummy troubles, right?
Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to induce vomiting,
that's
right?
That's right. So one source that I read has Agrippina herself feigning concern for her, you know, convulsing husband and daintily sticking this poison feather down his throat. Because that was a thing. They would use a feather to induce vomiting and stick it down your throat and tickle your gullet or whatever and then make you puke up the bad stuff. But instead, this feather was laced with an even deadlier poison.
Oh, and you know what? Let me step back just a second to clarify here. I think I've got the turn of events correct. So the day before the poisoning, Lucusta poisons the bodyguard, and the bodyguard has to call out sick, and then Agrippina bribes the food taster. So they removed two people from the equation.
See, she's thinking several steps ahead of even us.
4D space chess.
Crack podcasters. Yeah.
So dies because the feather has been poisoned. It's soaked in strychnine, right? And all of a sudden, immediately after the death of this emperor, Nero ascends to the throne, and they recognize that Lucusta, she has a lot of potential, especially if you are a power-hungry emperor, right? And there's an interesting pattern that transpires here because we mentioned she had been arrested more than once, multiple times. Twice she was arrested for murder, but each time she was arrested, a Roman senator bailed her out. People speculate it was kind of a way of buying a future kill.
Absolutely. She had friends in high places, no question about it. But the thing that's messed up here is that Agrippina, who obviously was trying to set these events in motion and get her boy Nero in the throne, she immediately threw Lucusta under the bus.
Immediately.
Immediately.
She said, she poisoned my husband.
I wonder if that was like a strategic move.
Totally. That's what they call getting ahead of it.
Yeah, but I wonder if it was really like Lacusta was in on it maybe, where it's like, all right, I'm going to take the fall for this because I'm already a known poisoner, or if she just was caught completely unaware. Whatever the case might be, Nero, who is now a power-hungry Looney Tune on his own.
Yeah.
Because Agrippina has really been jockeying for this stuff and trying to manipulate events. Mm-hmm. And now she's got what she wanted, more or less. But Nero, doesn't seem like he's acquiescing to his mother anymore. He's kind of got his own axe to grind in the form of another potential heir to the throne, a 14-year-old Claudius had given it sired under a previous marriage, named Britannicus.
Right, right. And Lacusta is in a terrible spot because the death sentence she receives is death by bludgeoning. And by the time Nero reaches out to her, she's been in jail for several months. Here's the deal he cracks. In about 55 AD or so, he frees Lacusta, the poisoner at this point, from prison. He gives her a bunch of money. He gives her some land, and he says he's going to make her an aristocrat, publicly absolved of all crimes she has committed or will ever commit, and all she has to do is poison this 14-year-old. Britannicus is 14 years old. All she has to do is poison this child. And reputedly, allegedly, Lacusta had one question. She said, do you want it to be fast or do you want it to be extended and painful?
Yeah, there's nothing monstrous about that, like, at all.
That's her concern about poisoning your 14-year-old.
Fast or protracted and painful.
She's like, look, I work for you now, Nero. So the story, now some of the details may differ here, Noel, but here's what I heard. I heard that Nero invited this 14-year-old, Britannicus, which, again, I like the name, to a huge party at one of the palaces, and they were passing around wine. 14-year-olds drank wine at that time. And Britannicus takes a sip from his wine goblet and then starts convulsing.
Is this the one, though, where, like, he had complained the wine was this is good. Oh, yeah, this is the one.
Yeah.
So apparently back in those days, they would dilute wine with hot water. So you'd be drinking hot wine. That does not sound very refreshing. With dinner, that was common, and I was not aware of this at all. And apparently, Britannicus found his hot wine to be too hot, so he wanted somebody to cool it on down for him. And the tasters tasted his hot wine, but they did not taste the cold water that was added to it to make it less hot. And that's, of course, where the poison came into play. Again, very, 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 very sharp, very smart.
Hot wine is just such a weird phrase. Would you guys like that on a t-shirt?
Mulled wine.
That mulled sounds wine sounds way better. Because you add some herbs. Yeah. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, hot wine sounds like the wine has gone bad.
Here's another interesting aspect of the story. Apparently, Britannicus might have had epilepsy, so Nero was able to say, no, don't mess with him. He's having an epileptic fit.
Yeah. And apparently, like, dinner went on as usual with the guest just kind of, like, awkwardly looking at this convulsing 14-year-old in the corner of the room and not wanting to offend the psychotic emperor, just went about their business, drinking their hot wine.
Drinking their hot wine, and it is a success. So instead of accusing Lacusta of murdering Britannicus the way Agrippina did, Nero says, you know, all right, done deal. Here's your land. Here's your house.
And treasures.
Treasures.
Pardons.
Yeah.
For all of the previous poisonings that she'd been accused of or convicted of or what have you, clearing her name.
Impunity, indemnity, and little cherry on top here, an official title, Imperial Poisoner. Nero even sets up a poisoning school.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and she was the head. Yeah, exactly. That's so brazen, though. It's like, I wouldn't think that's something you would, maybe it is. Maybe it's sort of like a, hey, look at me, I got my own poison, or don't mess with me kind of thing.
I guess so, yeah. Like, how much of it is a propaganda thing? But check this out. For the next 14 years, she is performing assassinations and poison, what would you call it? Poison operations? Poison projects.
Sure.
Yeah, she's doing that. And she has immunity from the law. She's above the law. And she did, she did train women in the art of poisoning at her school.
Well, we talked about this in the episode we did on a, like a brief history of poisoning or arsenic, I believe,
it was
right?
Very gendered.
Yeah, yeah, it was very gendered.
And
almost unfairly so. It became like a stereotype that was a little bit like the idea of it being like a woman's weapon or something.
Yeah,
like
I think
a little bit misogynistic.
It's incredibly misogynistic. Yeah. So she used over time a ton of different things: hemlock, belladonna, nightshade, arsenic. What's the stuff used to treat malaria? Quinine.
Yeah, quinine.
Quinine. Cyanide. Opium. Cyanide is a speculative thing, but the other stuff we know pretty much for sure. And she practiced the scientific method. She would keep track of what worked and how, which is why she asked questions like, do you want a painful slow death? Do you want something fast?
Yeah, I mean, I've almost seen her described as something of a researcher, like, you know, practicing that scientific method, trial and error, seeing what would have the effects that she wanted and what would be the best substance to use for a particular situation. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she had tons of notes and data on this stuff. It'd be fascinating to get a hold of.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have to wonder, is that stuff lost to history? Is it still around somewhere? Would you want to read it if it is? We can say that although life went pretty well for this arch villain for a while, it did not end well for her. You see, Nero always carried, this is so hardcore, Noel, Nero always carried a suicide poison kit that Locusta had made for him. And when he was sentenced to death in 69 AD and trying to escape his assassins, he forgot his suicide poison kit, so he killed himself with a knife. And the protection that Locusta had enjoyed for so long was gone.
Yeah, and with that, her prospects weren't looking so good.
Right.
Because she was very much tied to this notion of Nero, very similar to Caligula we talked about in the episode we did with Christopher Hastiotis about non-human candidates, where Caligula, the other insane, I mean, I'm sure there was more than one, but the another insane Roman emperor of note, mm-hmm. Nominated his horse to be a consul. When he died, a lot of his crazy stuff and the people, his hangers-on, you know, did not look too good and did not have the protection they needed to continue living the lives that they were living, such is the case with Locusta, because the people saw Nero as a dangerous force.
As a monster.
A monster, a completely narcissistic, self-involved megalomaniac who didn't care anything about the common people and only wanted to, like, you know, feed his lavish lifestyle and, again, actually burned part of Rome. Do you know the story about that? I'm not.
Well, here's how the story started there. The Great Fire of Rome, which is what that refers to, that myth of him playing a violin while the city burned, it comes from two people, Suetonius and Cassius Dio, who allege that Nero didn't play a fiddle, but that he sang a song called the Sacchivillium, dressed in stage like theater costumes while the city burned. And the idea of him playing a fiddle itself is propaganda. It's meant to help criticize Nero's earlier attempts to rewrite the Augustan models of governance and rulership. So it's
okay.
Kind of like Napoleon not really being short.
That's right. And then the Great Fire, they were blaming. It's not even 100% confirmed, but many historians do blame, or at least one in particular, a guy named Tacitus, mm-hmm. blamed Nero for starting a fire in order to circumvent the Roman Senate and right. to create like a hubbub so that he could, you know, usurp power and do whatever he wanted.
And being a total class act, Tacitus said that Nero accused Christians of starting the fire to take the heat off him. Sort of like a like mother, like son kind of thing.
Sort of a we didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world was turning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, situation.
Now the death of Locusta. Also, I want to correct. I think we said 69 AD for the death of Nero. That's not quite correct. It was in the late 60s AD. But Locusta, when we get to her death, we run full on, face first, into the realm of legend.
Big time.
We've got two stories for you.
Bit of a tall tale.
It's a long tale for sure. It's a short story with a long tail.
A long neck, really.
So the first one of the more commonly accepted, the more mundane stories, is that Locusta had tried to escape or lay low and continue getting away with her murderous career, but the emperor who came after Nero, Emperor Galba, was not having it, and Locusta was chained up and dragged through the street and then just executed. But there's another legend.
Yeah, it's a totally bonkers legend.
It can't be true.
I don't know. I don't know how you would even train a giraffe to do this.
Right.
But I did hear, this is a little gross, guys.
This is very gross.
Yeah, supposedly, you know, according to this particular version of her demise, Locusta was smeared with vaginal secretions from a giraffe, a female giraffe, and then
died as a result of the ensuing activity.
Yes, the ensuing activity from a male giraffe who was trained to do this thing.
So the good news is that is we can say with a high degree of certainty that probably didn't happen.
Just logistically, man.
It
doesn't seem.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, but it's definitely in the record. It's a legend for sure.
And it does bring us.
Oh, and then torn apart by wild animals.
And then torn apart. Yes, yeah, can't forget that.
That's huge.
But that's all part of the whole thing. So we looked into this, where this claim would originate. And this kind of stuff, like, it surfaces in the Encyclopedia of Serial Killers by a guy named Michael Newton, at least in the first version. But there's no precise date of death. There's no precise location. It's not really any confirmation that this happened. And when we talk about stories of people living in this time, especially people who had a lot of enemies, there's a ton of propaganda. There are a ton of made-up things that were meant to ridicule, mock, or vilify a particular person, right? Or event, or government, or institution. And the moral of the story is, I guess, that eventually justice did catch up with Locusta. Is she history's first documented serial killer? Well, it depends on how you define it, because the term serial killer didn't exist at the time. And then, you know, if she's doing this as a job, she's essentially doing hits on people. Does that make all mafia or yakuza assassins? Does that make them serial killers, or are they just people doing a job for monetary gain?
Well, that's the thing. And we also don't know, because of how free to go about her Mary poisoning way she was, if she didn't kind of get off on it a little bit, get some jollies from it, right? Because the definition of a serial killer that we use today largely implies some kind of abnormal release, I guess, that you get from doing it, or some kind of, like, you're compelled to do it. Uh-huh. Certainly it would not just a functional day job kind of situation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, it's comforting to me that eventually justice was served, but it is terrifying to think that someone could be acting with impunity, literally above the law, and have it be a known thing. I'm sure there are different operators for different countries' intelligence agencies who do stuff like this, who are, you know, legally required at times to take lives. But for this to be so blatant is surprising. And if even some of this stuff is true, this person was a monster, a real monster.
Yeah, I mean, the 14-year-old boy poisoning, where nobody would help him as he kicked and screamed and convulsed on the floor during a dinner party.
Horrific.
That's pretty horrific.
So that is the story of Locusta. And and one thing that we are running into with our Halloween-y or Halloween-ish episodes is this strange thing at the end where we get to the conclusion of a tale, and it's a real downer. We went through something dark and grim. We've got to bring the mood up, Noel. There's only one way to do it, and I think you know what it is.
Boy, do I ever. It's listener mail, Ben, and our first mail comes from a Yumi who writes, "Hello, historians. I'm listening to your episode, A Dead Pope Goes to Court, and you were wondering about mock accents in other English-speaking places. Now, I'm American, so I don't know firsthand, but much like with other foreign languages, a lot of English textbooks explore and show examples of English in different accents, up to and including foreign accents. I have one textbook that I use with high-level English as foreign language speakers that's from the UK, and the listening features conversations and monologues. They want to showcase many accents. However, for me, it's incredibly obvious that all the voices are being done by English people who are putting on accents." Mm-hmm. "And they do include that Italian accent with a character actually named Amario and an over-the-top Spanish accent for a character asking a friend if he would like more paella. I know it's something Americans do professionally too, so we're no better, but I thought you might like to know about that. Cheers, Ayumi."
That's great. Thank you for writing in. You've written in a couple of times. We always love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
And we want to be very clear here that whenever we're doing, of course, it should go without saying, but let's say it, whenever we are doing funny voices or accents, we're absolutely not trying to be derogatory at all. We sometimes think that we're funny. We're not even really so much making fun of Richard Nixon as we are enjoying doing that voice.
Yeah, making fun of ourselves. Because if you can't do that, then, you know, what good are you?
Exactly. If you can't laugh at yourself. However, this is a good segue. Speaking of being derogatory or using pejorative language, we'd like to read a short and sweet letter from Aaron M. Aaron, you write in and you give us some nicknames here. You say Vito Ben and Null Sapien. I think you all should do a segment on ridiculous historical insults. I thought you would find the link below comical and entertaining. This is from Aaron in Chicago. And there are some great insults in this source she sent us from Oxford. I don't know if you had pulled this up or got a chance to look at it, but there's a flibberty gibbet.
Flibberty gibbet.
Is it gibbet?
Gibbet.
I have heard
you know
that.
Why?
Yeah.
Because it's in a song from The Sound of Music called Nobody Has a Problem Like Maria. How do you solve a problem like Maria?
Yeah.
And it's like a flibberty gibbet, a will-o'-the-wisp, a clown.
Yeah, a chattering or gossiping person. And then there's a foozle.
Now, this one I don't know, but I love it. It sounds like something from like a Dr. Seuss book.
Someone who's behind the times.
A foozle.
There's slubberty gullion, a slobbering or dirty fellow.
Okay.
Kind of soiled or stained. This one sounds dirty. It's not a curse word, but just sounds dirty. Shot clog.
Ooh.
Like a shot clog is someone who's unwelcome in a social situation, but tolerated because he's paying the bill for everyone. He's a shot clog. And I don't want to spoil the surprise with more. Suffice to say, Aaron, thank you so much for sending us some of these cool, archaic, or ridiculous historical insults. Did you hear anything that particularly called to you?
No, not on that email. I actually haven't seen it. I need to dig it up now because I am intrigued.
Well, thank you to Aaron and Ayumi, and thank you to everyone for joining us on this strange journey. Huge shout out to our guest super producer, Paul Deckett.
And even though he's abandoned us, we can still give a shout out to Casey in absentia.
Mm-hmm.
And also to Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
And thanks to our research associates, Eves Jeffcoat and Christopher Hasiotis.
And, you know, thanks to you, Ben.
And thanks to you, Noel.
He's looking at you.
Thanks to both of us for not poisoning people for a living. I think podcasting, while not the most noble of professions, is better than being a poisoner, right?
How dare you? It's as noble as it gets.
It's better than poisoning people.
We're getting people through their shifts, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the ticket.
They're night shifts. Or they're day shifts. Or, you know, whatever.
They're shifting shifts.
Indeed.